Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to talk about the shocking differences between raw, unfiltered, unheated honey and the processed honey found in most stores, including a lot of health food stores. Big difference. And as a beekeeper and having helped raise bees for a long time, there's enormous difference. You'll want to pay attention to that. For those who do a lot of exercising and you want more cellular energy, got that. Fried foods, they interact with your genes, but not in a good way. The precise reason for health benefits of dark chocolate, the mystery is solved. And studies show that acai berries can fight cancer and boost immunity and more. Have a lot on health and nutrition, always from peer-reviewed mainstream journals. Then, from our environmental segment, you've heard people talk for the last 5 years about the 400 parts per million and that we can't get there. If we get there, then it's game over. Well, we're there. Yes, we are. So while all the politicians and all the corporate Democrats and all the good people on all the networks were talking as if they knew what they were talking about, we passed that threshold. What does it mean? Now, I'll tell you. Also, a doctor has had the courage to come forward and say that ADHD, it only exists to make big money for Big Pharma. From Chris and Marylaville blog, a good article from Occupy Corporation. Then we go to public health, and we're going to talk about how they're going to come right to you with radiation ads and how most people will be susceptible to that. Continuing with my ongoing commentary segment, the powers and abuses of America's mega corporations. The guest in the second part of my program is Professor Christopher Davidson. He'll be speaking with us from Durham, United Kingdom. Everyone's talking about what's going on now. We don't. There are certain things I do not talk about on the program because, A, I don't find them of interest. Sports, celebrities, the local politics, national politics, and pretty much what everyone else is talking about, I refuse to because I find it done to death and then exploited. But what are they not talking about? That's what we talk about. We're going to tell you about the coming collapse of the Gulf states and the entire reshaping of the Arab world. How about that? That you haven't heard before, and we always like to be ahead of the curve. Remember, 9 years ago, we talked about the 12 tipping points before a single radio program in the United States had talked about tipping points at all. We have been accurate. Now we're going to go further. We're going to say why the entire Middle East is going to be made over. There's going to be chaos everywhere. And let's see how accurate we are. Let's begin. I'm going to start with athletics. We have a lot of athletes listening. In fact, we have some world-class athletes listening because I've spoken with them and tried to help them with their nutrition, recovery, and energy. But let's just say you're a person goes out for a power walk because you know it's good for you. Or you go out and do some power biking. You don't use the gears. You put it in your most difficult gear. You're going to be burning energy. So what can you do to support cellular energy metabolism? Something that's not expensive, not difficult. Well, there's a simple, easy-to-obtain herb. It's called rhodiola. R-O-R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A. Rhodiola. Now, what it does, it promotes higher levels of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and CP, creatine phosphate, in the cellular power plants known as your mitochondria. And this provides more energy molecules needed to power your daily activities. In fact, in human trials, rhodiola aided exercise endurance after just a single dose. In a double-blind crossover placebo-controlled rhodiola increase several measures of mental performance, including associative thinking, short-term memory, calculation, concentration, and speed of audiovisual perception. So it's good for the brain, especially if people are aging. Generally between 200 to 300 milligrams is fine, and taken once a day. And it's not expensive. Generally a month supply could go for like $8. So it's really a great way to have more physical and mental energy and from a non-toxic herb that's inexpensive. We love fried food in America. The other day I started flipping through all the channels of the food. I couldn't find a single healthy food served in on any of the cooking shows anywhere. But also, they become extremely mean-spirited. The idea that you're racing against a clock, why? That you have to beat each other, who says? That you have to humiliate the other person and feel as if you should go shoot yourself if you don't win something, that doesn't make any sense. And yet that's the... And then they feed these idiot judges who act as if they really understand anything about food taste. No, these are just people paid to judge someone else who have no background or qualifications to judge even what they're doing. Let the judges get up and see how well they can do. I don't believe anyone should judge anything unless you're also the person who's done that. That's why former athletes make the best coaches, because they know what it is to be out there on the field or the track or on the court, because they've been there. So there's a different level of awareness. In any case, when you look at the food that you're being asked to appreciate, it's almost universally garbage. None of it is good for you. Here's the latest from Harvard School of Public Health. Fried foods may interact with genes to influence your body weight. Now, the results show, and this is, I'm quoting from Harvard School of Public Health, quote, that eating fried food more than four times a week had twice as big an effect on body mass index, that's the amount of fat on your body, for those with the highest genetic risk scores compared to the lower scores. Well, we know that fried food is bad for you. Why? Let's just break it down. First, because whenever you are frying a food, you're changing its chemical makeup. In some cases, the oil actually becomes similar to varnish. That's why there's only three oils you should really ever use for cooking. One would be the coconut oil, then the mustard seed oil, and then the macadamia nut oil. Now, at the end of the cooking, or at very low heat, then you could add other oils like olive oil, and you wouldn't destroy the nutritional value of it. Secondly, when you cook at a fry, anything that's a carbohydrate, you immediately change it into acrylamides, which are cancer-causing and speed up the aging of your cell. And thirdly, it's very difficult to digest. That food can sit in your stomach for hours. Food should be able to go in, be hydrolyzed, digested, made into almost like a thick milkshake. It's called chyme. Goes in, becomes bolus, which is what goes down your esophagus into your stomach, and then it becomes liquefied. Then it makes it easier to digest down your intestine, more complete digestion, and better elimination. Can't do that with fried food. Slows down your digestion tremendously. That means that food's going to spend more time on the sensitive lining of your intestines. Bad. That can lead to polyps and precancerous growths. So, get away from fried food. From Louisiana State University comes research that shows why chocolate is good for us. The benefits of eating dark chocolate I've been talking about for years on this program, and I distinguish between chocolate that is not organic, is overly refined, that it has added sugars and dairy, versus natural organic chocolate that is made without any harmful or toxic ingredients. And that's good for us, 2 to 4 ounces a day. So why? Why is it good for us? Well, they've looked at several reasons, and what they're coming up with at the American Chemical Society, which is the world's largest scientific society. Thousands of scientists attend. There's 10,000 reports on new advances in science on all kinds of topics. Quote, "We have found that there are two kinds of microbes in the gut, the good ones and the bad ones." This is from one of the presenters. The good microbes, quote, such as Bifidobacterium and lactic acid bacteria, feast on chocolate. When you eat dark chocolate, they grow and ferment it, producing compounds that are anti-inflammatory. Well, that's it. And the other bacteria in the gut are associated with inflammation and can cause gas and bloating and diarrhea and constipation. So, quote, when these compounds are absorbed by the body, they lessen the inflammatory and cardiovascular tissue, reducing the long-term risk of stroke, meaning chocolate does. And this was by Dr. John Finley, who led the research team at Louisiana State University. So now you know, you're fermenting that chocolate into polyphenolic polymers, metabolized to smaller molecules, which are easily absorbed, and these polymers are anti-inflammatory. They can turn off inflammation everywhere in the body, from your brain to your heart to your muscles. Once again, good healthy chocolate every day. From the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, done at the Department of Nutrition and Food Science, Texas A&M University, show that the acai berry possesses the highest antioxidant activity to date, and that means you trap more free radicals. It helps prevent macular degeneration, Alzheimer's disease. Also, separately, it has anti-cancer properties, according to studies at University of Florida, shown that acai berry extracts can kill leukemia cells when applied directly to them over a 24-hour period. Specifically, 86% of leukemia cells experience what is called apoptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S, or cell death, when subjected to the extract. The researchers attributed this effect to acai berry's high concentrations of anthocyanins, a type of flavonoid that gives the fruit their distinctive black-purple color. Also, from immune-boosting properties from Montana State University Department of Immunology and Infectious Disease, there's a polysaccharide within them, and it is a very powerful one that is known to induce T cell activity, thereby helping the body fight infections. So anytime you have an infection, for, quote, from treatment of asthma and infectious diseases, have the berries powder, A-C-A-I-S-I, and the polysaccharides are rich, rich, rich. So it's a kind of a galactan that's very beneficial. It helps you lose weight. And so that's our nutrient of the day. Now, a little longer, our classroom on the air today is going to deal with honey. And from The Natural Blaze, Karen Foster. Now, many of you know, and many of you have actually been to my home upstate New York for years. Thousands of people came every year, mainly from Memorial Day labor to Labor Day, and generally I would also go up almost Thanksgiving, so a little longer. People would come and spend the weekend and learn crafts, gardening, how to make tofu, tempeh, soy cheeses, fermented foods. All types of wonderful workshops every single weekend of the summer. It was one of the greatest times of my life. And that's where I met thousands upon thousands of our listeners. And then on Sundays, people could come up and they could take home with them for free all that they could fit into a giant garbage bag. And I always had an abundance of food growing and was happy to share it with people. But everybody was fascinated by the bees. I believe that there is a photograph up on my website, GaryNall.com. One of the many photographs, there's over 1,000 I have up there, that shows me covered in bees. I'm going to guess that there's about 10 to 15,000 bees on me. And I never got stung. I've never been stung. And I showed them how to extract honey. And then I explained to them bee pollen, bee propolis, how to have a healthy hive. And in fact, today, if you go up and look, you'll see from on our website, on my Facebook also, you'll see thousands of bees eating honey, raw organic honey, during the winter until there's blossoms and nectar and pollen, all of which are part of the pollination process. Because in wintertime, they don't get any of that. That's where they can starve to death. Well, there are well over 30 commercial producers of honey that have no traces of pollen and lack beneficial vitamins and enzymes, among a host of other natural constituents, which are removed due to pasteurization and processing. In fact, most golden honey you see at your local grocery store is dead and far from the health-promoting powerhouse of its raw, unpasteurized counterpart. Processed honey is not honey at all, and if you desire any kind of health benefits, you got to go to real honey. In the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration says that any product that's been ultra-filtered and no longer contains pollen isn't honey. However, the FDA isn't checking honey sold in the United States to see if it contains pollen. Now, what does raw, organic pollen or honey do? It's antiviral, antifungal, antibacterial, anti-carcinogenic, cough suppressant. It stabilizes blood sugar. It's rich in beneficial enzymes and nutrients. And it's superior in wound healing. It does a lot of good in the body. But once you find it, refine it, and they're using ultra-filtering, it's a high-tech procedure where honey is heated, sometimes watered down, and then forced at high pressure through extremely small filters to remove pollen, which is the only foolproof sign identifying the source of the honey. It is a spin-off of a technology refined by the Chinese who have illegally dumped tons of their honey, some containing illegal antibiotics, on the U.S. market for years. Food Safety News decided to test honey sold in various outlets after its earlier investigation found U.S. groceries flooded with Indian honey banned in Europe as unsafe because of contamination with antibiotics and heavy metals, and a total lack of pollen which prevented tracking its origin. And that's a big deal. Well, they purchased more than 60 jars, jugs, and plastic bears of honey in 10 states and the District of Columbia. The contents were analyzed for pollen by Vaughn Bryant, a professor at Texas A&M University and one of the nation's premier specialists in pollen in honey. And Bryant, who is director of the research laboratory, found that among the containers of honey provided by Food Safety News, 76% or more had the pollen removed, including stores like Walgreens, Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, a Safeway, Giant Eagle, Kroger, Metro Market, etc. But why would you remove the pollen? We can only assume to prevent the majority of the public from obtaining all the benefits found in raw honey. Removal of all pollen from honey makes no sense and is completely contrary to marketing, the highest quality product possible. Well, this is from Mark Jensen, president of the American Honey Producers Association. I don't know of any U.S. producer that would want to do that. Elimination of all pollen can only be achieved by ultra-filtering, and this filtration process does nothing but cost money and diminish the quality of the honey. In my judgment, it's pretty safe to assume that any ultra-filtered honey on store shelves is Chinese honey, and it's even safer to assume that it entered the country uninspected and in violation of federal law. So, what's wrong with Chinese honey? Well, Chinese honey has long had a poor reputation in the United States. Remember 2001, the Federal Trade Commission imposed stiff import tariffs or taxes to stop the Chinese from flooding the marketplace with dirt-cheap, heavily subsidized honey, which was forcing American beekeepers out of business. To avoid the dumping tariffs, the Chinese quickly began transshipping honey to several other countries, then laundering it by switching the color of the shipping drums, the documents, and the labels to indicate a bogus but tariff-free country of origin for the honey. Most U.S. honey buyers knew about the Chinese actions because of the sudden availability of lower-cost honey, but no one said anything. And the FDA, either because of a lack of interest or resources, devoted little effort to inspecting imported honey. So, mostly the adulteration went undetected. So what's the difference between a raw, organic, unpasteurized honey and the pasteurized processed golden honey? Well, the processing of honey often removes many of the phytonutrients found in raw honey as it exists in the hive. Raw honey, for example, contains small amounts of the same resins found in propolis, and propolis, sometimes called bee glue, is actually a complex mixture of resins and other substances that honeybees use to seal the hive and make it safe from bacteria and other microorganisms. Honeybees make propolis by combining plant resins with their own secretions. However, substances like road tar have also been found in propolis. Beekeepers sometimes use special screens around the inside of the hive box to trap propolis, and since bees will spread this substance around the honeycomb and seal cracks with the antibacterial, antiviral, and antifungal resins, the resins found in propolis only represent a small part of the phytonutrients found in propolis and honey. However, other phytonutrients found in honey and propolis have been shown to possess cancer-preventing and anti-tumor properties, and these include caffeic acid, methyl caffeate, phenylethyl caffeate. These are all, and dimethyl caffeate, these are all powerful. In fact, researchers have discovered that these substances prevent colon cancer in animals, and by shutting down activity of two enzymes that are needed for that. So when raw honey is extremely processed and heated, those are destroyed. So you get good bacteria when you have raw, unfiltered honey. There's at least six types of lactobacilli and four types of bifidobacteria in honey. And, for example, the lactobacilli, which deliver protective and beneficial benefits to bees as well as humans, were not found in the bee's honey stomach during the winter months when the bees under investigation were fed sucrose, white sugar, indicating that certain bee feeding practices may have dangerous and unwanted effects. Now, all the people I know that have bees feed them sugar. I don't. I feed raw, organic, unfiltered honey to the bees, and they thrive, absolutely thrive. And so that's what you want. Wound healing. You put some Manuka honey, high grade, on a cut, burn, a scratch. Watch it. It has mild antiseptic properties. It really speeds wound healing in topical applications. Strongly antibacterial. So that's our classroom on the air. To, you know, and how would you spot an artificial honey? Well, put a drop of the honey on your thumb. If it spreads around very easy or spills, it's not pure. If it stays intact, it's pure. The water test. Fill a glass of water and add 1 tablespoon of honey to the water. Pure honey will lump and settle at the bottom of the glass. Filtered, adulterated, and artificial honey will start dissolving in the water. And then pure honey will crystallize over time. Imitation honey will remain looking like syrup no matter how long it's stored. And then you can dip the tip of a matchstick in honey and then strike it to light. Natural honey will light the match easily and the flame will burn off the honey. Fake honey, you won't be able to get it. There's too much moisture in it. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Tomorrow I'll be talking about a Peruvian tree that contains 10,000 times more power against cancer than any chemotherapy drug, and why fluorescent lights are bad for you. From our environmental segment, and then our public health segment, then we'll take our break. This is the latest from Common Dreams. Quote, 400 parts per million. Just a matter of time before we cross the climate threshold forever. This is from Jacob Chamberlain. Climate scientists have long said that the Earth cannot withstand more than 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for very long without tipping the scales against human life once and for all. And according to Raf Keeling, who runs the carbon dioxide monitoring program at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, that atmospheric concentration was recorded last week for the first time. This year, 2 months earlier than last, now warms Keeling, it is only a matter of time before the atmosphere permanently maintains those levels. Quote, we are already seeing values over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Probably we'll see values dwelling over 400 in April, May. It's just a matter of time before it stays above 400. And he works with the team at Scripps and has taken daily measurements at the Loa Observatory in Hawaii since 1958, when carbon was at 313 parts per million. The 400 parts per million threshold was first recorded during a brief moment in the month of May last year, and that was published in Climate Central. It was the first time carbon levels had reached that high in human history. But, as Robert Monroe writes, quote, fossil fuel burning continues to increase concentrations of the greenhouse gas to levels not seen in human history, and not in perhaps as long as 5 million years. According to Monroe, quote, instruments at the Loa Observatory in Hawaii recorded atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide greater than 400 parts per million on March 12, 2014, nearly 2 months earlier than the date on which the milestone was passed a year ago. Scripps Institution of Oceanography and University of California, San Diego reported a reading of 401.62 parts per million on March 4th. So, there it is. So, what's the takeaway message? Why is this important? Because we've been told repeatedly by the leading climatologists that it's a earth changer when we get to and exceed 400 parts per million. What'll happen is that you'll have worse drought, using up the existing water supplies in areas that will never return. Now, don't confuse this with a coldest day, a coldest winter, the hottest summer, the most rain, the least rain, more tornadoes, more hurricanes. It is all related. And unfortunately, no matter how many times you try to explain this to the climate science deniers or their talking heads over at Fox, they still don't choose to get it. They're not stupid. They just act stupid all the time. We are going to see in the very near future that much of the United States will simply not be sustainable with its populations. We're running out of water. And when I tell you running out of water, we're running out now. Right now, there's over 200 towns and communities in the United States that have no water. And if they're not out there digging a well, which is very expensive and not always reliable, unless you have a great aquifer, and most places don't have aquifers. And those that have had aquifers in the past have had 100 years of overdraining them by cities. And so as a result, those people are finished. They have to move. You're going to see the greatest exodus of people moving off the land, out of towns, out of cities, than we have since the Great Dust Bowl, except this will be 100 times worse. Visualize what I'm about to say. Visualize this. They will keep the water flowing to San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, San Diego. They have to. But at a cost that everyone else. And in the next 5 years, California will no longer be the leading produce grower in the United States. There just won't be the water for it. Already, hundreds of thousands of acres are bone dry and will never be planted again. There are towns of 11,000 people that have no water. And now the state and the government, federal government, say, we have no more to give you. We'll truck in some water. Well, how do you truck in water for 11,000 people? You don't. So that's why I'm telling you, Arizona, Nevada, Oklahoma, Utah, South Dakota, Wyoming, most of California, half of Texas, and Georgia, all almost half of Florida, you better start looking at educating your population of what is necessary over a period of time to stop the development, stop the growth, and conserve your water. And that means people are not going to have lawns of grass. They're not going to have the resources that they have. Now, those who have money will go to where other people have money. So you have oases. You'll have places in Manhattan, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in all the major cities. You'll have places that will just be booming. Real estate will go up in value in this bubble because people don't want to be in a non-sustainable environment. So people that once had a beautiful estate in a place in Ohio, they'll move from there. And they'll want to go where other people are. So they'll find a place that meets their needs. And those people will live in a cloistered environment. You would never know that there's a problem going on with the environment or people or politics or poverty or anything. But then that's about 15% of the American population. That means 85% of the people are going to get slammed. This is from Suzanne Posel from Occupy Corporatism. Quote, doctor explains, ADHD only exists to make money for Big Pharma. Richard Saul, behavioral neurologist, MD, in Chicago, does not believe that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder exists. Okay. Dr. Saul says, quote, I have found more than 20 conditions that can lead to symptoms of ADHD, each of which requires its own approach to treatment. Raising a generation of children and now adults who cannot live without stimulants is no solution. According to a new report, the number of adults taking pharmacological drugs for ADHD has risen to, you ready for this, 53% in the young 20-somethings. Saul explains that ADHD has become, quote, an easy catch-all phrase to save time for doctors. In this world, as a population, meaning we, are more distracted today than ever before. And so therefore, people can toss around a label of ADHD for the profit of drug companies. And that's what has been happening. And because ADHD has gained in popularity, more drugs and copycats are available and increased the stimulants children were being given to suppress their innately tenacious behavior. Remember, it was the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 3 in the 1980s talked about introducing a classification for adults with a condition. Well, this led to more Americans covering up symptoms with stimulants without a worry of how the developing human brain will handle being synthetically altered. He said, today, the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual only requires one to exhibit 5 of 18 possible symptoms to qualify for an ADHD diagnosis. If you haven't seen the list, look it up. It'll probably bother you. How many of us can claim that we have difficulty with organization or tendency to lose things, that we are frequently forgetful or distracted or fail to pay close attention to details? Under these subjective criteria, the entire U.S. population could potentially qualify. We've all had these moments, and in modern amounts, they're a normal part of the human condition. A good reason to keep people on stimulants under the guise of disease is because stimulants are highly addictive. Quote from Dr. Saul, the body stops producing the appropriate levels of neurotransmitters that ADHD meds replace, a trademark of addictive substances. I worry that a generation of Americans won't be able to concentrate without this medication. Big Pharma is understandably not as concerned. So what are the side effects? What happens to you when you begin to take ADHD drugs? you increase your anxiety, you have more depressive moods, you lose weight, and you have erectile dysfunction. Saul warns that stimulants are a, quote, short-term answer, not the answer we need, and he believes that we have to look at normal behavior. And his patients are given a healthy diet, increase exercise, 8 hours of quality sleep, get rid of the caffeine, get rid of the using the cell phones all day, and find something to be passionate about. Good for you, Dr. Saul, for having the courage to say what 900,000 of your compatriots should have realized and should have said also. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you all over the world. I'm Gary Noll, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to go to Dr. Christopher Davidson in Durham, United Kingdom, to talk about the coming collapse of the Gulf states and the reshaping of the Arab world. Dr. Davidson is a reader in Middle East politics in the School of International Affairs at Durham University in the UK and an expert in the politics, economics, and sociology of the Arab Gulf states. In the past, he's been an assistant professor Zayed University, on the United Arab Emirates and Dubai campuses. He also consults for the UN Alliance of Civilizations. His recent publication, After the Sheikhs, the Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies, predicts that the pieces are in place for the downfall of the autocratic ruling families across the Gulf states during the next 2 to 5 years. So we're going to take a careful look at this. And he's received degrees from University of Cambridge and also a doctor from the University of St. Andrew in Scotland. We'll go to him in a moment. Mention two program announcements. First, because we have so many people who are seeking help, information, and because I do provide a free public service where people are given great insights and help from qualified individuals, we now have a greater demand than what we have a staff. So I'm going to be hiring two individuals, either part-time or full-time, who have qualified backgrounds in nutrition counseling and for nice-paying jobs. I pay them nice so they don't have to charge you anything. Your counseling is free. Give us a call if you would like to qualify and come in for an interview. I'll be personally interviewing on this and going to hire two more people. We already have five, but it's not enough. We've counseled probably 30,000 people from this audience to help them in their journeys of health and healing. You can call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, if you'd like to be interviewed for full-time or part-time work. And I pay a living wage. Secondly, to celebrate the end of a long marathon, the longest in this WBI's history, I'm going to throw a free dance party for the people in this audience. It's going to be the second Wednesday in April. It'll be from 7, which is a Wednesday, from 7 to 11. It's going to be wonderful. There's no alcohol or smoking or drugs, just happy, positive people coming together to celebrate a wonderful spring evening. If you want to come, call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And finally, once a week, we offer for this radio program, radio station, and I'm the only one that ever raises any funds. No other guest in 10 years has ever had to raise a single penny. So you, unlike NPR and PBS and Pacifica, you're known here constant fundraising. We selected for today something that is really unique. It is a $281 retail, you're only paying $99. You're saving $182. It is the 7 Steps to Perfect Health 14-hour DVD documentary series, beginning the process of changing your life, cleansing and rebalancing, detoxification, how we keep excuses at the forefront of our consciousness instead of looking at what we optimally and ideally should do with our body and our minds and our health, and de-stressing, how to shop in a healthy way for good foods and juices, how to exercise, and then everything we need to know about de-stressing. It took 14 hours to do this. This is 14 hours of video documentary. And people don't know how to start the process of change. We all have to change. We all should be doing healthier things. And if we don't, that we'll pay the consequence. So this gives you a way that no matter what your background, your age, where you're coming from, you'll have 14 hours of video documentary to watch. All right? This is a wonderful, wonderful way to get yourself on the road to good health and happiness and de-stress and cleanse and detoxify, unclutter your life, start over a new process of health and awareness. So that's it. It's the 7 Steps to Total Health. It's only $99. Every penny goes to the radio station. And you're saving $182. How about that? That's a phenomenal savings. So call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And it'll go out today. It goes out in the mail today. 877-627-5065 for 7 Steps to Perfect Health. 14 hours of documentary for you. I'd like to welcome all of you. Let's go now to the United Kingdom and say hello to Professor Christopher Davidson. Nice to have you with us today.
Many thanks for the invitation. Good to speak to you.
Often when I look at the Gulf monarchies, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman, Yemen, I imagine a surrealistic world of contradictions between medieval traditionalism and hyper-Western modern thinking. On the one hand, these are Islamic nations, and Islam forbids monarchies, kings and queens and family lines royally as legitimate rulers. Yet the populations have placated themselves to accept royal autocrats for decades now. I'm surprised this never comes up in any of the discussions in the media. And while most Arab populations renounce aggressive U.S. and European intervention, especially strong U.S. military and intelligence presences in their countries, the Gulf states solicit it, and a large amount of their national expenditures goes towards the purchase of military weapons and support for the West. So within the Arab context, how do you explain the legitimacy given to these monarchy families? And why did the Arab Spring not spill over into the Gulf states to the degree we saw in other Arab nations?
Well, they're very good questions. I think we really have to break it down to the internal and external sources of legitimacy here. In their own backyard, of course, the Gulf monarchies, for all of their faults, have managed to find ways to channel at least some of their oil wealth, their oil rents, to their citizens in the form of public sector employment, very often guaranteed for graduates, public housing, a whole raft of subsidies and other economic privileges and benefits afforded to their citizens. In that scenario, of course, the government is very much a giver of wealth to the population rather than a taker, as it often is in the United States with taxation. So you could really imagine a scenario where the people are essentially acquiescent, and demands for political reform, at least until the last couple of years, have not been that high. On the external level, we, of course, have the very strong relationships that these Gulf monarchies have enjoyed with the Western powers. In many ways, we can see this as a sort of extension of the distributing wealth strategy, using the oil rents they have to spend 2 or 3% of their GDP on Western and often American armaments. That's not to say these F-16s and Abrams tanks that they're buying will ever be used in combat, but it's a sort of guarantee. If you buy this from America and something goes wrong, as it did for Kuwait in 1990 when it was invaded by Iraq, then the implicit understanding is that America and the Western powers will come and bail you out. But as perhaps we can talk about, over the past 2 or 3 years, many of the circumstances surrounding those deals have somewhat changed to the disadvantage of the Gulf states.
I appreciate that oversight. Thank you. How important is the peak oil card and the ability of the states to sustain their extravagant welfare systems? And the monarchies, in effect, buy, as you mentioned, their population's loyalty and passivity and political stability through elaborate welfare handouts in education and subsidies and food and housing security and no taxes or small taxes and health care to its citizens. At the same time, youth unemployment is high and continues to rise, so the ability to keep the massive numbers of disenfranchised youth at bay is premised upon the sufficient and growing oil revenues to sustain the welfare model. And then parallel to an increasing population is higher energy consumption as well. One question is, how long will this be sustainable in a world of peak oil and a booming population of youth that is challenged by what they're not receiving, and do you foresee a perfect storm on the near horizon regarding the monarchy's ability to continue relying upon oil to keep their systems of governance in place?
Well, yes, on this economic front, as we move forward, there's no doubt that at least half of these Gulf monarchies are facing a situation where their, let's call it their break-even oil price, that's the price they need for a barrel of oil on the international market in order to balance their government budget is going up and up at a time when oil prices are very flat and, if anything, likely to come down, not least because the United States shale oil revolution, plus many other parts of the world, are bringing oil on tap like never before. I think the United States has now overtaken Saudi Arabia as the world's leading producer of oil. This is going to have a significant impact in the next few months. If we look at a country like Oman, we have a break-even oil price of about $105 a barrel. That's pretty much bang on what the price of Brent is today. In the case of Bahrain, where we have a break-even price of perhaps $115 a barrel, this is a supposedly oil-rich Gulf monarchy, which is now firmly in deficit. The picture for the others is a lot less clear, but again, we're receiving strong, compelling signals from bodies such as the IMF that their budgets are not going to balance for much longer. As you mentioned, they're having to grapple with rising young populations that are all wanting jobs, subsidies, employment. So the states are under increasing strain. And often what's rarely left out of the picture is the enormous domestic energy consumption of these states in their own right. So even on paper, they may appear to be oil rich. The chunk of their oil production that's increasingly having to go to satisfy domestic requirements is on the rise. For example, the Gulf monarchies collectively, despite their small populations, are now consuming more oil than Japan and Indonesia combined.
Qatar is one of the highest users, isn't it?
Yes, Qatar has a national population which probably fits inside one football stadium. The rest of the population are expatriates, most of whom do the actual work and labor in the country. Qatar has a GDP per capita of probably $250,000. So it's probably, in many ways, can be regarded as the wealthiest state in the world. But the overconsumption is absolutely phenomenal. So we're entering an era where we can't really talk about how many years of oil or gas these states have left to produce, but how many more years they can still have a surplus to actually export.
Well said. We also have to consider the peak water. Many of these countries are running out of water. They're also running out of arable land, and now the conflicts of renting, leasing, buying land around the world is foremost in many of their minds. But all of the Gulf states have managed to avoid poverty in their nations, aside from the conditions of immigrant workers, largely from the Philippines, Africa, and Southeast Asian nations. I feel there's some truth in stating that the seeds of fundamentalist religions, such as jihadist movements, are more likely, but not exclusively, sown when poverty and abhorrent living conditions are present. Now, with unemployment growing in the Arab states and more economic stress being placed upon their welfare policies, Will poverty become an issue in the near future? And what do you see is the likely outcome, since in the United States we are virtually controlled in the mainstream media by those who wish to see conflict? From Bill O'Reilly and Charles Kreisheimer and others, and on Fox Network and through newspaper, we keep saying we're weak, we should do something decisive against Putin, and we should go after Saudi Arabia, and we're promoting that Israel has every right to go in there and start a war and knock out Iran. And what is the likely outcome that this is going to start to spill over into other Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia, that has been working with Israel in challenging what's going on with Iran and some other states?
Yes, I think these are all very key pressures that all of the Gulf monarchies and their international partners are having to think about. Firstly, with regards to water security, obviously in these desert states, this is a major concern, especially with the rising population and the growing cities. We also need to think about food security as well. It's why many of the Gulf states are increasingly having to use more and more of their sovereign wealth to buy up arable land elsewhere in the world. With regards to poverty, one of the greatest myths, perhaps, about the Gulf monarchies is that there's no working class or poverty-stricken section of the population. In countries like Saudi Arabia, which now has more than 20 million citizens, this couldn't be further from the truth. The mainstream media rarely covers issues of poverty and unemployment in the Gulf states. They're often treated as being somewhat aloof from the problems of the rest of the Arab world, or, if you like, ring-fenced from the authoritarian republics where we've seen the Arab Spring take place. But if you actually drill down, if you pardon the pun, in the oil-rich Gulf states, you actually find that many of the same conditions that existed in North Africa and Syria are now rapidly taking hold there. Saudi Arabia, as I mentioned, has this large population, and it's now becoming extremely obvious that many of the population are living in very poor conditions indeed. And as you rightly mentioned, this also provides breeding grounds for jihadist movements, for young men wanting to have a greater purpose or cause in their life. So they're going off to fight in Syria and parts of Iraq in the same way that their previous generation of young Saudis went off to fight in Afghanistan and Pakistan, some of course even joining Al-Qaeda. With regards to the last point about conflict, we have a very worrying situation here where Saudi Arabia and many of the other Gulf states are essentially trying to stoke up a sectarian conflict in the Middle East, which is starting to spread from Syria into Iraq, across the border into Lebanon, Bahrain and elsewhere. The narrative basically being that the Shia are extremists sponsored by Iran, and they must be dealt with. But of course, they're being dealt with by the Gulf monarchies very often sponsoring extremist Sunni groups, which we're all reading about now in Syria and elsewhere, which are even more brutal than the people they're supposed to be fighting against. So For the American and Western hawks who wanted us to intervene in Syria last summer, we need to hold a deep breath and think of exactly whose side we were about to intervene on behalf of. And of course, we look at the anger and frustration in Saudi Arabia and, as you mentioned, Israel, these two key American proxies who are now extremely concerned and worried that when they click their fingers, America no longer comes to their aid. So both of these countries are now thinking long and hard about their future security arrangements, perhaps beyond the United States, and what they need to do to ensure their security as they move forward.
I just have one last question. That is that there's an increasing strong-arm tactics by the Gulf autocrats to police and prevent increasing criticism or dissent and freedom movements, particularly in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. What would you predict is the likely outcome in the next 2 to 5 years? And also, what do you see for Dubai, since it has received only positive thoughts as this oasis of extravagance for the rich and the famous, But I do not see it being, I see it as being one of the most vulnerable because it's encroaching sea levels and all of it is built upon sand, not upon rock. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think over the next few years, we're perhaps entering the last chapter for these Gulf monarchies, at least in terms of being actually able to portray themselves as benevolent regimes which have the popular backing of their populations. While it's difficult to predict exactly what will happen, whether it would be revolution in some states such as Saudi Arabia, coups in wealthy Qatar, or hopefully a shift to constitutional monarchy in more peaceful places such as Oman and Kuwait, which already have some of the necessary political institutions with which to do that, we can't really be sure. I think with regards to Dubai, is not as successful and glossy as it seems. Since the Arab Spring began, it's enjoyed a bit of a sort of boost to its economy, given that it's been more stable than other parts of the Arab world where revolutions have been taking place. But you can't really build a future on always being a little bit more attractive than your neighbors. We, of course, had a big crash back in 2008, 2009, when a giant chunk of Dubai's GDP based on real estate was wiped out. I'd like to say some of the lessons have been learned from that period, but if we take a close look at the indicators today, we think we can see that a bubble is once again forming. Off the top of my head, Dubai has to reservice debts of $78 billion over the next 3 years alone, and I'm not sure really where all that's going to come from.
Appreciate your input. Thank you very much for your good work on this. And what is your latest work? I want to make sure I have that one stated to our audience. Is that
the latest book is published in the States by Oxford University Press, New York, and it's called After the Sheikhs, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies, which really looks at the politics and the economics of these six monarchies over the next five-year period.
Nice to have you on, Christopher. Thank you.
Many thanks. Bye.
Professor Christopher Davidson from Durham, United Kingdom. I'm Gary Nall. That brings up the end of a program, and I thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from a student from UCLA, doesn't give a name, and says, I began listening to you 2 years ago. I'm studying economics, and quite frankly, I've gotten more from your discussions about the economy and corporatization than I've ever gotten in my classes. I find your insights unique. She says, the professors here seem to live in a sheltered, secluded world, not the real world, and your predictions consistently come true. There's something that I'm still uncertain about. On the one hand, we're told to lower taxes and to the 1% to spend more and stimulate the economy. On the other hand, we're told by the left to spend more on entitlements to help the poor. I know you disagree with both of these, but I'm not sure what a practical solution is. Could you help us out?
I could offer a few insights. I disagree with both the corporatization model that is out there, nor Keynesian. All of the existing economic models fail to take into consideration what the actual needs of a society are. I believe that we should start creating a new model that is not based upon growth, but rather sustainability. When the model of economic status is we must continue to grow, and therefore how do you grow? Well, you have to increase your profits. You increase your profits by buying up other people's businesses. You create mega monopolies. And then where do you make your profit? You make your profit by getting rid of labor costs. You do that by outsourcing. And so you might end up with higher profit, but then where do you put your profit? More often than not, you park that profit in other subsidies outside the United States. Hence, $31 trillion is resting in banks outside the United States because they don't want to pay a higher corporate tax than what we have right now. And right now, for all intents and purposes, our taxes are around 39%, but in some cases, based upon how much we are taxed on what we buy, it goes higher. We should do the following. First, we should create new models where the intent is to give a living wage to the people working with you, no matter what position they are, to stop the people at the highest positions, and so they can't make their whole day about how they can position themselves for greater bonuses and premium value to the corporation. you should also have citizens sitting on all of the boards of directors, so therefore that the people's interests are taken into account on the services of a corporation. At least they're there for advising, not necessarily policymaking. And then we should stop all outsourcing of jobs, and then we should start to have manufacturing zones brought back in the United States, where with intention we make it easy for a corporation to open up and to manufacture anything that they choose in an area where they will be given special tax advantages if they hire local people, if they provide living wage, and if they pay their taxes. And a flat tax is what we should be doing. If you want to escalate taxes, put the escalation into a purchase tax, where the most essential needs of life are the lowest taxed and the luxury items the highest ones taxed. That way you would re-stimulate companies doing in the United States what they're now doing in India, China, and Bangladesh, and then re-incentivize. We should be reinvesting in infrastructure. And it should be mandated that what we're now putting in the military-industrial complex, $1.4 trillion a year, put $1 trillion back into the infrastructure, and you've just hired 5 million people to work in rebuilding the infrastructure, which we have to anyhow because of climate change and because of the poor roads, the gas lines that are 100 years old, and water lines, and replant America. Those are just some of the ideas. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're discussing the fight for jobs, justice, and equality in the Postal Service.
Good. Right now, Utrice Lead.